This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
Now listen to this.
You are listening to AWOL Radio on CKMS The Sound 100.3 FM in Waterloo. We are also podcasting on the Rabble Podcast Network at rabble.ca, and you can find AWOL on the web at peaceculture.org.
Maybach music.
This is for all land defenders with attitude. Facing off greedy land developers mad at you. OPP handing out charges like cans of food. At the Daily Bread Food Bank, they have to prove. Six Nations are terrorists on the whack of news. CTV, CBC, Global, lacking truth. April 28, Basics News, packing crews. Indie media, journalists who attract the view. Canada respect treaty rights, don't act a fool. If you don't respect treaty rights, we attacking you. At the School of People's Journalism, packing truth. Come in peace, that don't work, bring back the troops. Native Youth Movement, Cis Native Saskatoon. Red Power Mohawk Warriors, that salute. And protect all living things, we have to choose. Life over death, Mother Earth, we backing you. It's right to rebel, we have the right to rebel. Workers have rights, Six Nations have rights. It's right to rebel, we have the right to rebel. Earth has a right to animals and plant life. It's right to rebel, we have the right to rebel. Workers have rights, Six Nations have rights. It's right to rebel, we have the right to rebel. Earth has a right to animals and plant life. Years back, the OG told me, little homie, choose your comrades slowly before they sold me. The slavery, rat-infested hell grow moldy. No phones, walls have ears, move low-key. Stay clear, armchair, radicals, dead weight. One wrong move, and imperialism checkmate. Internal opposition, won through debate. External opposition, done when you dig graves. Mass education for babies through hip-hop. Advanced education for workers in big shops. One full day, defending land in your lifetime. Learn more than 1,000 books at the right time. Sunrise to nighttime, go defend land, I'm sacrificing 4-7 generation lifelines. It's right to rebel, we have the right to rebel. Workers have rights, Six Nations have rights. It's right to rebel, we have the right to rebel. Earth has a right to animals and plant life. It's right to rebel, we have the right to rebel. Workers have rights, Six Nations have rights. It's right to rebel, we have the right to rebel. Earth has a right to animals and plant life.
Comrade, off of Land Defenders for Life, Comrade Music, Volume 2. Check it out on SoundCloud. Swamp Line 9, lots have happened since last week when the occupation started. Earlier this week, a raid happened on the site. We're going to read the press release from swampline9.tumblr.com. Hamilton police direct mass arrest at Enbridge blockade. June 26, 2013. Hamilton police moved on to the Swamp Line 9 protest action in Ontario this morning, mass arresting almost everyone on site, including activists further up the street and the police liaison. Activists have been occupying an Enbridge pumping station north of Hamilton, Ontario, early Thursday morning. This action, dubbed Swamp Line 9, aims to prevent construction on Line 9 and block the transport of tar sands through Ontario and Quebec. This action is also part of the Idle No More campaign, Sovereignty Summer. News is developing. Much of the photographic evidence was seized, but some footage will be coming soon. Some quotes. This pipeline puts the health of drinking water of millions of people at risk of an oil spill, yet Enbridge used the courts and police to arrest 20 people who wanted to protect their lives and our future. Another one. This was a political action. We demand the release of those arrested and insist that their charges be dropped. A third quote, the police went above and beyond the limits of the court order by arresting people off the property, people who were on the sidewalk, and even the police liaison who was on the street. This heavy-handed tactic comes on the heels of Hamilton police receiving over $44,000 from Enbridge recently. Destructive Enbridge projects across Ontario and tar sands projects across the country will continue to be resisted. You can check out more background on that, swampline9.tumblr.com. And the campaign against pipelines in Ontario continues. Shut down the tar sands by choking out every possible exit route for that dirty, dirty crude. This is the Smash the State Report here on AWOL Radio 100.3 Sound FM, CKMS in Waterloo, Ontario. It is Friday, June 28th. Host Dan Keller in studio with you today, getting started a little after our usual start time. It's been a busy afternoon. And to follow up with the Swamp Line 9, we're going to be playing an interview done by the Daily Gurs and the Grand River Media Collective's Amy Scott. She interviewed intervener in the National Energy Board process and local environmentalist Louisette. And we're going to play that piece now.
You are listening to the Community and Resilience edition of the Daily Gur. Today is June 26, 2013, and my name is Amy Scott. We are now moving into the feature portion of our broadcast. This feature is an interview I did yesterday, June 25th, 2013, at Kitchener's City Hall, where community members were rallying against Line 9 and in support of those activists there now. Here is the interview.
Scott, and I'm here today at Kitchener City Hall, where community members have gathered to support those activists stopping work at Enbridge's Line 9 just outside of Hamilton, Westover. I am here with,
Louisette Lon Tang. I'm a member of the Grand River Environmental Network and KW Stop the Tar Sands.
So maybe we can start off with, who is Enbridge?
Okay, Enbridge is a pipeline manufacturer. Their job is to create pipeline infrastructure and manage the flow and flow rates of materials that are transferred through their pipes. So it could be oil, it could be natural gas, it could be water, all different kinds of product.
And I heard you saying earlier today at the rally, who funds Enbridge?
Well, currently, Enbridge is like a plumber, right? And currently they're being hired by Imperial Oil, which is a branch of Exxon, to move and reverse the flow of Line 9 to allow tar sands oil to go from Alberta to Sarnia. And the Line 9 goes from Sarnia all the way to Westover Terminal, and then it goes to Montreal. Now, this pipeline project that they have is with the intent to move it not only to Montreal, but to shipping companies along the Atlantic coast, where they could basically sell the oil to China, the bitumen that's produced from Alberta. So this is a pipeline route from tar sands going east across Canada. And we here in the Grand River watershed have the pipeline route crossing over our area.
Okay, so why are activists there stopping this?
Well, basically, the activists are from Six Nations as well as concerned citizens. And they are protesting because this crosses over territorial lands, and they did not seek the proper approvals from these bands that are affected. It also crosses over watersheds, which are vital to protect our local economy and our provincial economy. These pipelines are putting at risk in our area the Grand River and the Mith River. And those are main water supplies for communities downstream, like Brant and Brantford. And if we pollute, or if there's any kind of a rupture of the pipelines, then we're compromising our economic system throughout the Grand River watershed.
Is there a risk of these pipelines breaking and spills?
There already has been a history of multiple spills regarding Line 9, and the majority of these came from an issue of tenting of the outer layer of PE tape. The PE tape is a plastic tape designed to protect the pipe from corrosion, but what happens is sometimes the plastic puckers up and it rips, and that has resulted in the rupturing that we have seen so far along Line 9. This pipeline has been here already since the 1970s, and it was designed to move oil that was in Montreal to Sarnia. Now with the reversal of flow, they're going to move tar sand oil from Sarnia to Montreal and then to port cities across the East Coast.
Okay, so what's happening at Line 9 Westover right now with the activists?
Well, the activists set up shop about 5 days ago. They literally shut down the work that was taking place to build phase one of Enbridge Line 9. Now, this would allow the oil transfer from Sarnia to Westover. They stopped that construction by occupying the Enbridge Line 9 terminal. Now, today, just this morning, they received an injunction which stated they had to get off the property. Some people are risking arrest while others are moving the protests across the street to continue their protests against this oil pipeline.
So how can people in KW or across Canada help in either Line 9 or other Enbridge pipelines that they want to fight against?
Well, we know for sure that the primary intent of this pipeline is to continue the flow of tar sands oil. And we already see the result of climate change right now in Calgary's floods. We see climate change taking place globally. We do not want to build more infrastructure that locks us in to having to burn oil as fuel. The only way they can afford to build this pipeline is if they continue burning that oil and using it up. And this is the one way that we are taking a stand in our region to say enough is enough. We can no longer develop new projects to burn oil. We have to put our support behind renewable energy and energy sources that will not put our water supply or our economy at risk. And if people want to help this motion, please follow the Twitter feed for Swamp Line 9. Or follow them on Facebook or Tumblr. It's Swamp Line 9. The reason they're called Swamp Line 9 is because the pipe currently crosses through Beverly Swamp, which is a very sensitive water area for our groundwater recharges. You're welcome.
And thanks to the Daily Gurr, Grand River Media Collective, and Amy Scott for that interview. No Line 9, stop the pipelines right across this continent. They're going to lock us into this carbon economy, and we need to get out of it. It's destroying us. Here's an artist that folks take inspiration from for her words and her actions. This is Oasis, Firewood for Idle No More.
Oasis Nadishnikovs, and this is Firewood for Idle No More.
Creator draws a circle around us. It extends experience and beyond, tracing back through our past lives, bloodlines, ceremonies, and songs with no corner to turn to, nowhere to hide from the truth. Opacity is quick to subside, intrinsically exposing me to the universal root in the confines of your mind. Find medicinal fruit. We are the woods to reclaim. Well, hey, to them we'll go. Well, whoa, what's one is us. We know we'll grow. Whoa, what's the firewood for? Oh ho, I don't know more. The universe recreated every moment to be rebraided for the unknown. Sing to the seeds. Power is unity. There's no harvest alone. They call this 4D. All relatives realize I call this me. We divine creators, are you ready to speak? Tongue to tan, lies grew truth and leaves. Words breathe long before me by trees. Ripe are your ideas for the picking. Cause living in your thoughts is not enough. Start aligning self with a sense of everything. One people, one heartbeat we become. Each with unique meaning. Our own, said the sounding of a clenched stone. Though this never-ending cycle is a revolving echo, you may never get back to what you plant and borrow. We are the woods to reclaim. Well, hey, to them we'll go. Well, whoa, what's one is us. We know we'll grow. Whoa, the firewood's for idle no more. Aho. Potential empowerment provides us with an opportunity to act. It's what makes creation possible, corruption stoppable, blockage tracks. Cause in reality, there are infinitely many modes of being. Bite into life, it implies different ways of seeing. We have what we need to rise, believe it.
That was Oasis with Firewood for Idle No More. She was at the show last Saturday, June 22nd, at Caesarium, and it was a wicked, wicked spoken word hip-hop show. Oasis was there, True Rez, we had James David Hudson and Krista Williams. Ashling Legate was in for that, as well as host Janice Lee, and I don't think I forgot anybody. True Rez, James Blood from True Rez was capping it off. Wicked stuff. You can check a couple bits from Oasis out on YouTube, and I'm going to play them today, too, on Smash State Report here. And from Elsie Pogtog, we got an update from APTN. No frack. Stop the fracking. No more hydraulic fracking. Is that clear enough? I do hope
more so. More now on the escalating tensions at those anti-fracking protests in New Brunswick. That's where RCMP have made several arrests, and some vehicles and equipment were burned. Now the leader of the First Nation at the center of the demonstrations is asking the province to cool things down. Chief Ern Sock is asking the province to issue a moratorium on shale gas exploration in New Brunswick. Sock's community, Elsie Buktuk, is located in Kent County, where a resources company is searching for shale gas deposits. Protests have led to over 30 arrests and gained the attention of United Nations independent observers. Tensions have been running high between RCMP and the protesters since the exploration began in late May.
And there has been over or around 30 arrests, most of them Indigenous people. One of the reports saying that a non-Native was a protester who was on the road at one point trying her hardest to be arrested. The cops just took her off to the side of the road and kept arresting the Indigenous folks blockading. Fracking destroys watersheds and... Just as, or potentially at the root of this, there's also treaty responsibilities and treaty rights to consider here, of course. Destroying a watershed of Indigenous people would be, I would consider, an example of something that would be in contention of a treaty or would break a treaty of peace and friendship and respect and coexistence. There's agreements for these things. They were figured out a while ago. Let's just start upholding them here, Canada. And the agents of Canada, whether they be corporate or, you know, official. And sticking on the East Coast, Maine protesters arrested for trying to block oil train to Canada, from the PressHerald.com. Police arrested six people Thursday night after a group protesting fracked oil tried to block a train that was expected to pass through town by erecting a makeshift wooden scaffold on the tracks. The scaffold, with a banner that read, "Stop Fracked Oil, Maine Earth First," was put up to call attention to climate change and prevent about 70,000 barrels of crude oil from reaching New Brunswick, said Megan LaSala, one of the protest organizers and a member of 350 Maine, a group that's concerned about climate change. Quote, "We believe the moment we're in terms of climate change, is a dramatic one, and it calls for dramatic action," said LaSala, 26, a Portland resident who works in Unity. Portland, Maine being the end terminal for Line 9. About 30 protesters gathered at the intersection of Route 201 and Route 139, many of them wearing white in an effort to look like workers at an oil spill, bearing signs that read, "Trains for people, not oil." Police closed both highways because the protesters refused to move. Police told the crowd by megaphone that blocking the rails and roads is illegal. At 9:40 p.m., the protesters were arrested by the cops, or the cops moved in to remove those that would stand up to protect the land. And shortly afterwards, they knocked down the scaffold. We're still not sure exactly on the train. Trains carrying crude oil through Maine from the Balkan oil fields of North Dakota, where it is fracked or extracted by blasting chemicals deep into the ground at high pressure to release oil from shale rock. LaSala said the process pollutes air and water in the surrounding communities. She said the protest Thursday was part of a national movement called Fearless Summer, with a goal to expose the dangers of extreme forms of energy extraction. The protesters' chants called for an end to fracking in North Dakota and explained their reasons for the protest action. Officers from the Kennebec County Sheriff's Department, Maine State Police, the Fairfield Police Department, and other law enforcement agencies, probably, you know, FBI was probably there, responded to the protest. Actions. Blockade. Good work. Good work. And a piece that I had a really hard time actually getting a full version. And I'm not sure if this one is or not, but I'm going to read it here. Ha! Is Canada a petro state? Oh, right. I couldn't get a full version of the piece I wanted to read by Andrew Nikiforuk, who says Canada has become a reckless rogue petrostate, but Ishmael M. Darrow did publish a review of the article. Huh. Is Canada a petrostate? Calgary-based writer says Canada has lost its ethical compass in pursuit of oil money. Calgary-based author and journalist Andrew Nikiforuk says Canada has become a rogue petrostate under Stephen Harper's conservative government, and he's taken to the pages of an influential American magazine to make his case. Writing in Foreign Policy, Nikiforuk says Canada has shed its polite Boy Scout ethic and now pursues a reckless domestic and foreign policy platform fueled by the cursed elixir of political dysfunction. Oil. It's funny that he thought Canadians were Boy Scouts. I wonder if he knows about colonialism. Quote, since the Conservative Party won a majority in Parliament in 2011, the federal government has eviscerated conservationists, Indigenous nations, European commissioners, and just about anyone opposing unfettered oil production as unpatriotic radicals, writes Nikiforuk for the July-August issue of Foreign Policy. Continuing, it has muzzled climate change scientists, killed funding for environmental science of every stripe, and in a recent pair of unprecedented omnibus bills, systematically dismantled the country's most significant, long-cherished environmental laws. Unquote. He places much of the blame, as it were, at the feet of Prime Minister Stephen Harper. Quote, a right-wing policy wonk and evangelical Christian with a power base in Alberta, ground zero of Canada's oil boom. Unquote. Continuing, just as Margaret Thatcher funded her political makeover of Britain on revenue from North Sea oil, Harper intends to methodically rewire the entire Canadian experience with petrodollars sucked from the ground. In the process, he has concentrated power in the Prime Minister's office and reoriented Canada's foreign priorities. Nikiforuk's harsh appraisal of Canada in the international press comes only months after University of Waterloo professor Thomas Homer Dixon made similar complaints in the pages of the New York Times. In a March op-ed, Homer Dixon wrote that Canada is beginning to exhibit the economic and political characteristics of a petrostate. Although both writers point out the more resource-intensive process required to produce Alberta's oil sands bitumen, their main concerns are that Canada's economic and political systems are being warped by the influence of the oil industry and the government's focus on becoming an energy-exporting superpower. Criticisms of oil sands development has been muted in Canada in recent years, and a majority of Canadians seem okay with further resource development, as long as some environmental safeguards are in place. It's not exactly a settled debate in Canada, but for people to pay attention, the criticism increasingly needs to come from sources abroad. Oil and gas account for almost 8% of GDP and 18.5% of exports, according to the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. So what are the characteristics of a petrostate? Is it one where the economy is dominated by oil and the government highly dependent on its revenues, so much that it distorts the rest of the economy as well as the political system? Petrostates typically have weak institutions, a high concentration of wealth, and power in the hands of a few, and deep economic and political inequality. Does that sound like Canada? Depends who you ask. There's a poll on this. Do you think Canada is a petrostate? Yes, absolutely. No, not even close. We are headed that way. I have voted. O.Canada.com, a piece by Ishmael N. Darrow. Thanks for that. That was actually some nice wrapping up of Andrew Nikiforuk's article from Foreign Policy. All right, what we're going to do is a piece from Owasis.
Owasis Nadishnikaz, this is Take Back the Night, and you're watching BlackCoffeePoet.com. Your inner beat keeps reaching to breathe infinitely, only to slip into the cyclicalness that's our community, learning of the oppressors and taking aim, knowing what it means to say your name, to wall the universe in your native tongues, blood to your heart, air you need to your lungs, light before a prism, brilliantly beaming, are our ancestors' ways, now to our being, these words moving moments and weaving movements, feel more real than expected, familiar, and lucid, familial spirits beyond belief, crying, this is urgency. We are the ones. This is the time. The love we have stuns. Let your inner fire shine through pitch black night, as fierce as the now. Take your fist and raise it proud, because all your life you've been fighting this fight. It's what rapists call nature and survivor's strife. Who's left and who's right? Whose land? We've lost sight. We're taking back our bodies, taking back our right. Let our grandmother moon take back the night. I'm asking you two spirits, sisters and brothers, how do you treat yourself and each other? What pulls you towards what you love? You need to know where it is you are coming from, to know who you are and where you're going, to let yourself be deeply drawn to the glowing. Are you speaking and acting authentically? What is your being if not peacefully? Like a body's release of moans, rid yourself of boxes, leaving only bones, returning to the earth, this much is known. My body cannot be owned. We are the ones. This is the time. The love we have stuns. Let your inner fire shine through pitch black night, as fierce as the now. Take your fist and raise it proud, because all your life you've been fighting this fight. It's what rapists call nature and survivor's strife. Who's left and who's right? Whose land? We've lost sight. We're taking back our bodies, taking back our right. Let our grandmother moon take back the night. Land rights extend to body autonomy. I'm anti-exploitation, pro First Nation sovereignty. Reclaim your voice, your presence is relevant. Root yourself, but acknowledge your settlement. Our cities are what remain of fur trade day dynamics. Not much has changed. It's still our lives at stake. Indigenous sisters missing with no action by the state. It's still lower wages we make, but a new world ours to create. So let your voice pierce the sky, your kind heart and spirit fly. We are the ones. This is the time. The love we have stuns. Let your inner fire shine through pitch black night, as fierce as the now. Take your fist and raise it proud, because all your life you've been fighting this fight. It's what rapists call nature and survivor's strife. Who's left and who's right? Whose land? We've lost sight. We're taking back our bodies, taking back our right. Let our grandmother moon take back the night. Keep tuning in to blackcoffeepoet.com.
And from justiciaformigrantworkers.org, demand justice for Ned Livingston Peart. Attend the Human Rights Tribunal. By the time you hear this, it will be too late. That is all right to attend. However, what is good to address is that there was a Human Rights Tribunal here, and I'm going to read the invite anyways. Justicia for Migrant Workers invites the community to attend the closing day of the historic Human Rights Tribunal examining the workplace death of Ned Livingston Peart, a Jamaican migrant farm worker who was killed working in tobacco farm in rural Ontario. This case is intended to bring forward changes to prevent workplace deaths and injuries and to improve working and living conditions of migrant farm workers in the province. There has never been an inquest into the death of a migrant worker under the Seasonal Agricultural Worker Program in Ontario or anywhere else in Canada. We need you to help us fill the Human Rights Tribunal for the last day. Check out J4MW on Twitter or hashtag Justice for Peart. He was killed by a tobacco kiln. He was crushed to death. He was one of over 300,000 temporary migrant workers at toil without full status or rights in Canada. Staying with it, Public Speaks Out Against Border Reality TV Show. From bccla.org, the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association delivers over 1,400 forms filled out by individuals refusing permission to be filmed by CBSA, Shaw TV, and show producers. In Vancouver, in less than a month, over 1,400 people have signed forms refusing permission to be filmed at border crossings by the Canada Border Services Agency, or the CBSA, or its private film crew partners for the reality TV show Border Security. This morning, the BC Civil Liberties Association sent over 1,400 forms signed so far to the Canada Border Services Agency, Force 4 Entertainment, Shaw Media, National Geographic, and BSD Media. The BCCLA says that filming travelers' interactions with border officials for entertainment violates their privacy rights. Quote, over 1,400 people have signed a legal form refusing their permission to guest star on the government's border reality TV show. This sends a strong message to the government and its private partners that it's not okay to violate people's privacy rights. People should be able to travel and deal with border officials without having reality TV crews in their face, said Josh Patterson, executive director of the BC Civil Liberties Association. CBSA should give up its Hollywood dream and focus on its job, unquote. Last month, the BC Civil Liberties Association launched an online form at bccla.org/not4tv in response to signs posted at the border. The signs tell travelers that they may be filmed for the TV show while crossing the border. The online form allows individuals who have crossed the border or who plan to travel outside of Canada to legally refuse permission to be filmed by the CBSA or its private film crew partners. The signs inform travelers that they may be filmed at the border, but that their image will be altered if they do not agree to be identifiable in the Border Security reality TV series. The original version of the sign stated that merely by being present at the border, crossing travelers gave their voluntary agreement to appear on the TV show. At Vancouver International Airport, the signs are actually posted past the main CBSA entry point, suggesting that most people entering Canada at the airport would not see the sign until after they may have been filmed. Quote, this show features travelers who are having difficulties with their border authorities. These people are in no position to give valid and informed legal consent to be on this TV show while they are being questioned by border guards or are otherwise under the control of law enforcement, Patterson added. Continuing, blurring people's faces is no solution because people who know you may still be able to identify you, and we think it violates privacy rights for the government to participate in the filming in the first place, unquote. The BC Civil Liberties Association has partnered on this initiative with the Cancel Border Security Campaign. Hersha Walia from No One Is Legal says she is not surprised by the public response. Quote, we were confident that people from diverse backgrounds would be outraged once they realized what was happening at the border. This is not an issue of censoring a legitimate journalistic production. This show exploits people in vulnerable and humiliating circumstances. The border is not a neutral public place. It's a place of anxiety for most travelers and migrants. Walia concluded, the government should not spend thousands of tax dollars in financing this unethical show, nor should it be participating in this show by doing sensationalist cop-style interviews or handing over footage from its cameras to be broadcast on this show. We encourage the public to continue to fill out online forms to refuse their consent and to voice their opposition. And you can check that out on bccla.org. Public speaks out against border reality TV show. Some more shameful and disgusting news, to quote Dan Sawyer on his Twitter account. OSSTF President Ken Corin is going to be running for the Liberal Party. What a class traitor. The Kathleen Wynne Liberals have landed a star candidate to represent the party in an upcoming by-election in London West, AM 980 has learned. Ken Corin, the current head of the Ontario Secondary School Teachers Federation, will be introduced as the party's candidate during a nomination meeting hosted by the London West Liberal Association on Tuesday, July 2nd. The seat has been vacant since the last douche left it. And that is gross. And now he's going to run for the very party that imposed legislation against his people. They impose legislation. Back to work, they impose that legislation on teachers. What a sellout. What a class traitor. I'm not one that usually goes on to class politics but and jumping too far into union issues. But come on, man. And I think Dan Sawyer got it right on Twitter. Shameful and disgusting. Shameful and disgusting. Speaking about a little more shameful and disgusting, a quick piece from rabble.ca. Unmasking Bill C-309. Newly passed legislation threatens freedom of expression. This piece is posted up by Sana Malik. Last week, Bill C-309, the Preventing Persons from Concealing Their Identities During Riots and Unlawful Assemblies Act, was given royal assent. Also known as the mask legislation, the law makes it illegal to incite a protest wearing a mask or any face covering, including face paint. Wearing any type of face covering while participating in a riot or unlawful assembly can lead to criminal conviction, despite opposition from civil liberties activists. The law has moved a maximum penalty from 5 years to 10 years in prison if convicted. The bill was put forward by conservative douchebag MP Blake Richards of Alberta. In April, the BC Civil Liberties Association stated that the adoption of Bill C-309 threatens constitutionally protected freedoms of expression of political views. Quote, costumes and masks are lawful, and they can be a powerful aid to unpopular speech, unquote, said Josh Patterson, executive director of the BCCLA. He continued, they can help foster an uninhibited expression of political views. The anonymity of a mask can protect people who are voicing their political opinions from punishment or reprisal by government, employers, family, and others. In some cases, the masks and costumes themselves may be a political message, such as wearing a polar bear suit to a climate change rally. Unquote. The BCCLA pointed out that the new law would also threaten the presumption of innocence and potentially expose people to criminal penalties in an arbitrary way when they have no intention or knowledge that they are committing an offense. For example, the association noted that in a large street protest, such as those recently seen in Montreal, police might declare the gathering illegal if a handful of people blocks away smashed a window, without hundreds or thousands of protesters realizing it. This would, the BCCLA stated, mean that anyone in that crowd wearing a costume or a mask would instantly and unknowingly have their lawful protest turned into a crime punishable by a prison term. Stephanie Pinch of rabble.ca has a breakdown of the five ways Bill C-309 will affect activists. Crystalline Krause, also writing earlier in rabble.ca, highlighted how Bill C-309 is fashioned closely in line with the disguised with intent law. Mark Carlin of Truth Out stated, quote, there is no masking that the one seemingly civil liberal society to the north has become a handmaiden to U.S. pro-global corporate policy at the expense of a vibrant right to dissent. Dylan Reed contrasted the modern moral panic around the mask wearing to decrees in the 16th century in France, and there's links to all that stuff. And again, that's a piece by Sana Malik up on rabble.ca on masking Bill C-309. Newly passed legislation threatens freedom of expression. And one more piece before we go to some audio from guardian.co.uk, and I'd suggest that the undercover cops, including Brenda Doherty and Bindo Shohans, check this out. The sexual behavior of undercover police fits the definition of rape. I'd say all the G20 undercover cops check that shit out, but once again, the sexual behavior of undercover police fits the definition of rape. It's a piece posted up on theguardian.co.uk. The case law shows that undercover police officers who slept with protesters are on dangerous legal ground. And of course, this is in the UK, but interestingly enough, we share a lot of the aspects of our laws. One of the 11 women who are currently suing the police after being tricked into having sexual relationships with men, later revealed to be undercover officers, said that she felt that she had been, quote, raped by the state, unquote. We were sexually abused, she said, because none of us gave consent. Chief Constable Mark Creedon, who is leading an inquiry into the units in question, acknowledges that officers might be prosecuted as a result of some undercover activities, but says of the sexual involvement that it is a bit like lying about whether they are married, saying, it happens. What a douche. Nick Herbert, then Minister for Police and Criminal Justice, claimed that a specific ban on undercover officers having sexual relationships would provide, quote, a ready-made test for the targeted criminal group to find out whether an undercover officer was deployed among them. Right. When police lie their way into criminal gangs, pretend to be willing participants in wrongdoing in order to disrupt it or apprehend wrongdoers, that level of undercover work has far fewer moral question marks over it. But these police have lied their way into women's intimate lives. Some of the suits against the police call this inhuman and degrading treatment, as well as deceit, assault, breach of privacy, and misfeasance in a public office. There will need to be detailed examination of each case in court, but these relationships appear to have been deliberately donned as aspects of undercover identity. Although deceived as to whom their sexual partner was, a female protester could nonetheless give him credibility in the world he wanted to infiltrate. Wear a woman as part of your disguise, it's quoted. Rape is sex without consent in which the perpetrator does not reasonably believe that the complainant is consenting. It is common sense that these sexual acts fit the definition of rape, and it could be the legal position too. Consent is agreement by choice by someone who has the freedom and capacity to give it. And as the Irish rape case of Dee said a century ago, the person by whom the act was going to be performed was part of its essence. One is surely deceived in multiple ways about that essence as a protester conned into sex with a policeman on duty to bolster his believability. Chief Constable Creedon may be sweeping too much up into his summary that deception happens in sex without making it rape. The position of these officers is very vulnerable indeed. If anyone wanted to test the law as it relates to rape and undercover policing, then all bets are off, and that extends to their superiors if they conspired in or condoned their deception. Again, from theguardian.co.uk by Vera Barrett. The sexual behavior of undercover police fits the definition of rape, and perhaps officers involved in undercover operations leading up to the G20 in Canada would like to start looking into some of their relationships, and perhaps the public would like to start looking into the behavior, the very bad behavior of some of these cops in Canada as well. It's not just happening in the UK, in the US, you know. PRISM isn't just an American thing. Going to some audio. In a press conference on Wednesday, June 27th, the Mohawk Council of Ganaakwe, Chief Lloyd Phillips and Clinton Phillips announced the plan of action in regard to Canada's S2 legislation. The MCK will be approaching the community to give the mandate to use the urgent lawmaking provisions in the community decision-making process to begin the creation of a Gananoque law to counter the Family Federal Homes on Reserves and Matrimonial Interests or Rights Act, or S2. The legislation received royal assent on the 19th of June, and the new regime will come into force 1 year from the date that will be established by an order in council to be passed by Canada. Here is that press conference.
Well, thanks for being here on short notice. I know it's not a usual event. We have a press conference for what some people may see as a relatively small announcement. But the reason why we want to put it in this way is for two reasons. One is the fact that it is news in terms of a new process in which we're using. This is the first time that we are going to be utilizing the urgent lawmaking process within the community. Council recently supported that process, and at the same point also agreed that this matrimonial interest law for Ganawaga should be the first one to go through it. Obviously, because of the nature of this law, where it could have no direct impacts on our community, or will have direct impacts on our community if nothing is put into place, and also we're going to be putting together a communications plan within the community, which we're hoping the media would also help us and get a message to the community. What we're going to be doing is actually later on next week, we're going to be putting out a preliminary information sheet to the community on what is S2 and how does it impact our community and impact you as an individual, more importantly. And also in later on in July, we'll have more detailed information coming out, further explaining the law, further explaining the reason why we feel it's important to have a Ganawaga law to displace this one. and I guess maybe to a certain extent justifying why we need to go through a urgent law process. Also in August, we're going to be rolling out more. We're going to be doing some community surveys in the community to see what type of feedback we're getting in terms of concerns on if how people feel if this needs to be an urgent law making. So that's all going to be rolling out in August, as well as we're looking at probably doing some kiosks at the service complex to, you know, directly engage community. You know, we'll have our technicians on the file. Joe Dalleron will be a part of that, as well as Paul Nicholas will be part of that as well, along with Clinton and I, who are leading the file. So there are a lot of things that have been happening over summer. As we all know, the community decision-making process is a lengthy process. And this is the first time we're using this urgent lawmaking. So we're hoping to shrink this down into a much quicker process, whereby we can put something in place in the short term and displace outside laws, while also continuing the engagement with the community, you know, for a longer, more in a more permanent law to be take place to displace S2 legislation. And this also, maybe as a final note before, I'll see if Clinton has anything to add, but certainly it's important that to know that up front that we're going to be advocating to have this law go through a process as an urgent, and we're going to be advocating that's being done. I know in the past, you know, we put information out to the community and saying, here's the information, what does the community think? We're going to be doing very similar, but I don't want to put no punches behind it and no misnomers in saying that what we're trying to do here. We're going to be pushing and saying this is something we community has to do, we should do, and give you the rationale for it, and actually recommend it to the community that it be placed as an urgent lawmaking. Ultimately, the decision is still with the community. Phase one of the urgent lawmaking, it goes to the community in a very simple question. You know, does the community want Ganawage matrimonial interest law to be in the urgent lawmaking process, yes or no? So once that question is yes, fine, that engages the process, and we can move very quickly on that. If the answer is no, which we hope it isn't, then we'll engage the longer, much longer process. But CUMI has to know up front, if we engage a longer process with all the other laws that are currently in process, it probably will not be done in time for the federal legislation to take effect, thereby allowing this law to apply to our community and allow offload into provincial government in terms of matrimonial real interests in our community. So there's a lot of implications there. I know I said a lot in a short period of time, but I know we're trying to get here as quickly as possible. But if Clinton wants to add something, if not, we'll answer a few questions on it and we'll take it from there.
I guess maybe just to add to what Lloyd just said, and it's just echoing his words already, the importance of getting this to the people and getting the people to, I guess, realize how urgent this really is. I mean, without the people's support, we will have to go to the community to ask them if indeed they believe this is truly an urgent law. And if they say no, then it's no. So we need to really push the fact, promote the fact that we truly believe that this is urgent, and without their support, it's going to be, we're not going to go anywhere slowly. And it's just, again, to really push the fact that, we need to be, council's on the same page. We all believe that, we all believe that we need to act as soon as possible. Actually, today, we need to act today. And I guess this is the first wave of a blitz that we'll be doing in the community. We're looking at next Friday, actually, I guess, July 5th, to be the first day where MCK will be putting a very brief, like a 101-ish type of paper into the community, just to kickstart this blitz, if you want to call it that. And throughout the summer, there'll be a wave of information coming out. We need the community to look at and see everything, the good, the bad, and the ugly of this law that, again, Canada's pushing down our throats, not just our throats, but across Canada, and painting us all with the same brush again and again without consulting us which is the norm for the federal government these days. So it's something that we need to be on top of, and we are on top of it. With, you know, make no mistake about that, we are on top of it.
And that was up on YouTube, published June 26th. And again, the Mohawk Council of Ganawake Chiefs Lloyd Phillips and Clinton Phillips announced the plan of action in regard to Canada's S2 legislation. Staying with it, an argument over a sliver of farmland threatens to nullify a historic agreement between Quebec government and the Ganawake First Nation. The mayors of four South Shore communities, the racist mayors of four South Shore communities announced Thursday they will attempt to block Quebec's decision to give back a 300-acre plot to the Ganawake Mohawks. The land was appropriated by the provincial government in 2006 to make way for the construction of Highway 30. Quebec and the Ganawake Band Council have been negotiating for years to find a suitable replacement for the upended Mohawk land. They finalized the agreement last month when Quebec signed a decree handing the 300 acres over to Ganawake, marking the first time in the community's history that a government body actually gave land back to the First Nation. But on Wednesday, a lawyer representing the neighboring cities of Châteauguay, Saint-Constant, Saint-Catherine, and Saint-Isidore filed a motion with Quebec Superior Court to have the groundbreaking decree tossed out. The South Shore mayors claim the decree is illegal and that they were never consulted throughout the negotiations. Whoa. They weren't consulted. They weren't consulted? Welcome to our world, Ganawake Grand Chief Michael Delisle said in the interview with the Gazette. We've been having our land ripped from under our feet, some might even say stolen from us, since first contact. Now we have a chance to get a good, valuable piece of land back for the first time in 300 years, and this is happening? It's really frustrating. Can't believe that is happening. As the population in the Montreal Area Reserve continues to grow, land is becoming an increasingly scarce commodity. One of the most common complaints among the 8,000 residents of the territory is that it's difficult for young families to find usable plot on which to build a home. Ganawake is a territory of about 1,300 acres, much of which is marshes, swamps, or other types of wetland. And with government inaction on land claims covering 65,000 acres... This is just complicated. Smash State Report here on AWOL Radio. Almost done. We have news of a pretty historic step that happened down in Thorold. It was happening at a historic commemoration into the War of 1812, and it was more than the monument that was set up. And following a call to attention by the Thorold town crier, Mr. Bertinac, gave a brief explanation of events of the running battle of Beaver Dams on June 24th, 1813, between roughly 400 Haudenosaunee warriors and 600 U.S. troops. He ended by explaining that very site was, as far as be determined, the place where the seesawing battle ended before the formal surrender. But the most moving portion of the afternoon's event was yet to come, following brief speeches by Thorold Mayor Ted Lukiani, who expressed his appreciation of the site. It was time for Six Nations Legacy Consortium CEO Rick Hill to speak. Mr. Hill explained the viewpoint of the natives' warriors in the battle. He displayed the replica of the wampum presented by the Haudenosaunee by the British following the War of 1812, the belt to signify the covenant between the two peoples, a covenant the British would not keep. He explained the intricate design of the beads and the belt and its meaning while he waited for his guests to arrive. When they did arrive, Mr. Hill explained that there had been a rift between the Six Nations and the Haudenosaunee of the Montreal Nations because of the unjust distribution of rewards following the Battle of the Beaver Dams. In the words attributed to Native leader John Norton, quote, "The Ganawake fought the battle, the Mohawk got the plunder, and Fitzgibbon got the credit," unquote. Mr. Hill acknowledged the inequity of the situation and offered reconciliation with the Montreal area nations. As a symbol of their reconciliation, Mr. Hill offered his guests, Akwesasne representative Curtis Lazor and Thomas Deere of Ganawake, a beautiful crafted war club made by artisans at the Six Nations Reserve. It was explained that this club would be passed from hand to hand until 2015, when the involved nations would meet at Burlington Heights, now Dundurn Castle in Hamilton, to reenact the peace ceremony of 1850 and bring the war club's journey full circle. Mr. Hill's guests were also presented with a commemorative medallion struck for the occasion, meant to be brought back to their people. Both spoke in agreement with the sentiments expressed by Mr. Hill, Mr. Deere in Mohawk. Several spectators commented later on the beauty of the language and how it created the meaning to the ceremony, even if they could not understand it. Not a sound issued from the crowd during all this time. The weight of the ceremony's significance seemed apparent to all in attendance. In the short time we have been standing there at the corner of Davis and Old Thorold Stones Road, surrounded by the fields which once played host to a fatiguing and bloody battle, 200 years of enmity between Haudenosaunee nations was set upon the road to resolution. And that was on whatsonthorold.com, / State Report here on AWOL Radio. We're wrapping it up. Clicking buttons. We're going with being, you know, pretty much the second, or on Twitter I said it was the three-year anniversary of the G20 in Toronto and the violent police crackdown on civil protest and civil rights and, you know, all the crap the police did. Well covered on AWOL Radio. Check our archives on rabble.ca. We're going to a song from it. And this one is Last June from Gallows here on AWOL Radio. Smash the State and check out grandrivermc.ca for the Daily Gurr.
Like the pride before the fall.